Hello, everybody. It is said that throughout the ages there has always existed the divine wisdom, the knowledge of the true nature of God and man, and the relation between them in an intelligible universe. Of course, we cannot know it in its fullness, but nevertheless, we are led towards an understanding of these great ideas in all the great religions and philosophies. It is the essence of the message which great teachers have given to one civilization after another, the same core of truth, though clothed in different forms to meet the changing needs of man. But at times this tends to get lost under an accretion of superstition and false learning, which hides the pure wisdom that is always there for the seeking. And so from time to time a fresh impulse is given, and the veil is once more lifted, that all who have eyes may see. This does not mean that new truths are uttered, but rather that the old ones, which are eternal and unchangeable, are restated and synthesized in the light of the knowledge of each succeeding age. In the last century there came the Theosophical movement, founded by Madame H. B. Blavatsky and Colonel H. S. Olcott in New York. A body of seekers joined themselves together in an effort to seek and find the wisdom of the ages, an attempt to lift a little of the veil of truth so badly needed in the new materialistic era which had then just dawned. From those early days, there has emerged a body of knowledge drawn from many sources in an effort to synthesize the wisdom to be found in all revelations which have come to man. This has been called theosophy, theosophia, which means divine wisdom. Now, this is not a new religion. It does not draw people or intend to draw people away from the faith which they already follow. It is rather an underlying philosophy and way of life which they can discover within the framework of their own religious teaching. What is more important, it can appeal to minds at every level and ranges from deeply metaphysical concepts to simple truths which each one can understand. It's also a way for every temperament, whether he be the intellectual, the devotee, the mystic, or the occultist, and along each of these paths, the seeker learns the same basic truths inherent in all the great teachings. Let us now consider some of the questions which must confront every thinking man and woman at some time or other in his or her life, especially when he or she must face crisis, grief, and apparent injustice, and find out whether this philosophy about which I am speaking can help to answer such questions to our satisfaction, not merely intellectually, but in order that they may become a guide for our life and action, in order that they may give us some feeling of understanding of the underlying purpose and meaning in our lives. Now, the first question which arises is, what is man? It was Alexander Pope who said that the proper study of mankind is man, and the ancient psalmist cried, "What art man that thou art mindful of him?" In ancient days there was the injunction, "Man, know thyself." And yet it's strange but true that of all our knowledge, the knowledge of what we ourselves really are, what makes us tick, is probably the least understood. It is true that some people have a vague conception that somewhere there is a soul and even a spirit, but there's very little other idea as to what man really is and what is his relationship to the universe. Now, the study of theosophy gives us the idea that man is certainly not his body, that he is a spiritual entity clothed in bodies of flesh and feeling and thought through which he experiences the phenomenal world. This spiritual nature of man, so it is postulated, is part of the spiritual light of the life of the universe, that is, one with and part of the divine nature. This spiritual nature, therefore, is eternal and incorruptible, and is not destroyed by the death of the physical body. St. Paul expressed the idea of the true man being something apart from the body, his instrument, when he described the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible. He also described the divine nature in each man as the Christ in us, the hope of glory. Now, there's one difficulty which arises if we accept this postulate of man's divinity and the Christ spirit within. How do we explain the differences apparent in the world with men of different capacity and spiritual unfoldment? Some men are still at the savage stage, while others display saintly and pure qualities. This brings us naturally to the idea of evolution. Evolution applying to the development of faculty and the refinement of form, together with the gradual unfoldment and greater expression of the divine spirit within. If we accept this idea, we can realize at once that people in the world, though all endowed with the same spiritual life, are at different stages of evolutionary development. Some have begun to unfold their innate capacities and are giving the true self within ever greater and wider means of expression. Yes, you might say that's all very well, but there's still one question which arises. Is it by chance that some souls acquire, through heredity, the refined physical body and capacities developed through a long line of ancestors? In that case, he has not developed his own inherent faculties at all. He has merely taken on the qualities developed by others by previous generations. In that case, he might just as well have been born into a savage body with less developed brain. It would just be a matter of chance. If we accept the idea presented by some schools of thought that each soul born into this world is a fresh creation of God, it becomes even more difficult to explain. Now it's here that we must realize that some other explanation is required. If we are to reconcile the different levels of unfoldment with the idea of man as a spiritual entity, if we are prepared to concede the existence of a spirit, then there is an intellectual need to get rid of the notion that we are born by accident. There is another explanation which does free us from this difficulty, and that is the idea of rebirth or reincarnation. This is an idea which, for some strange reason, has not been universally adopted in the West, though in most Eastern thought it is an accepted doctrine. If we think of the spirit within each one being born again and again in a physical body, then we'll realize that it comes into a family whose parents provide it with a body suited to its evolutionary need, through which the spirit can express himself according to the stage of development. In other words, we take on one suit of clothes after another, developing and refining them so that they become ever more perfect channels for the expression of the divine self within, the real intelligence. To put it in another way, through our evolution, we are working our way through the school of life, and each time we are born into a new class in order to learn the lessons which life has to give us. We learn through the natural law of cause and effect what to do and what not to do if we are to have happiness and well-being. Now let's here give a little more consideration to this law of cause and effect, sowing and reaping. Because it is postulated, this goes hand in hand with the law of rebirth and makes its rationale intelligible to us. There's an accepted axiom of modern science that action and reaction are equal and opposite. This is the law of nature which links together causes and effects, and it's applied without difficulty in relation to the physical world. However, if we examine it carefully, we can see the same law applying to each one of us, and an understanding of it is necessary to conceive the justice and purpose of reincarnation and the many experiences through which we pass. Under this law of natural causation, every human action, mental, emotional, or physical, produces an appropriate reaction. Thus, diversities of human experience, whether of disease, sorrow, weakness, or limitation, all health, happiness, capacity, and opportunity are reapings from past sowings. As St. Paul said, "Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." Thus, if our words and actions in the past have helped and cheered and comforted others, so will help and cheer come back to us. If in the past we have sown unhappiness and frustration, sorrow and loss will come back to us. In this way, we mould our own characters, We develop our inherent capacities. We learn life's lessons, and so we grow. With the operation of this law, we begin to understand the differences in environment and opportunity into which people are born. Each one comes into the conditions which he himself has created by his own past actions, and which he needs for his lessons in the school of life. Not merely as punishments for past deeds, I don't think we should look upon it just like that as simply a punishment, but rather as opportunity for growth, development, in order to develop qualities of resistance, patience, endurance, and so on. We can test this law for ourselves in a small way. We know that if we fling a rubber ball hard against a wall, the strength of its rebound will be in exact proportion to the force of the impact. We know that if we put our hand in the fire, it will be burned. If we eat things which are not good for us, that there will be a corresponding effect on our health. We know that if we are emotionally disturbed, angry or jealous, for instance, this will have a definite effect on our physical well-being. So in many ways we can see this law at work. Now if we expand the idea of this law to a much wider sphere, embracing a whole series of lives, then we'll see that we are products of our own past, makers of our own destiny, gradually learning lessons from which we will gain wisdom, understanding, and peace of heart and mind. And we realize, too, that nothing can come to us which is not of our own making. And we can see that there is an underlying law of justice in all manifestation. When we begin to realize this in our daily lives, then we will have a completely new attitude to all that comes to us. We'll lose the feeling of injustice, self-pity, resentment against fate. While our problems may continue, for we have already set in motion many actions which will have reactions in the future, we'll meet them with a new spirit of understanding, non-resistance. We'll recognize them as lessons which will help us to grow to greater maturity. There's no greater teacher than life itself, not only its sorrowful aspects, but its joys and happiness as well. Now let's give a little more thought to the mysterious subject of death, since this is still one of the greatest problems which confronts mankind. Throughout the ages, man has probably more than any other question asked about death. What happens when I die? Where will I go? Shall I live again, or is there extinction? Will I go to heaven or to hell? The question of man's immortality seems to have been asked since the dawn of individual self-consciousness. These are natural questions, of course. The uncertainty as to what lies beyond the grave more or less affects every one of us. It is safe to say, perhaps, that nearly all men do desire to live after death, though not all believe that they will. Because of the fear and uncertainty and the desire to get as much as possible out of life, irrespective of the rights of others, an understanding of the purpose of life and the processes of so-called death and the laws which govern them is needed for us not only to give hope, but a new attitude for each one of us and our relationship with our fellow men. Now we have seen by what I said earlier that man should not be identified with his body, that he is a germ of the divine life which is evolving by means of experience gained through the body, and that he therefore has more than one body of form through which he gains experience, thus developing his character and faculties. With all this explanation, we begin to see that death is nothing more than the casting aside of a body that is no longer wanted, just as we would cast aside a suit of clothes which was worn out. In most cases, the body is worn out, whether by old age, disease, or by some sudden or violent injury. Even in the case of the death of an infant, the soul has gained some experience that was needed for its development. When a man dies, then, he simply goes out of his body, casts it aside, but he still exists in a finer vehicle which is invisible to our ordinary eyesight. By leaving his physical body, he himself is in no way changed, is still the same person with the same desires and emotions, the same intellectual powers and aspirations. He still feels the same affection and friendship for those he loved. He's not cut off from them. He does, however, so it's suggested, begin a process of withdrawal, in the sense of becoming less immersed in things of the physical world. He begins to assimilate the experiences of his earth life, both the pleasures and the pains, so that the seeds of them are carried into the future life as faculty, understanding, character. Of course, I've simplified the process for the purpose of this talk, but if you want more detail, you are invited to read some of the literature available on this subject, for time doesn't permit me to go into it fully now. With an idea such as I've given, death will lose all its terrors for us. We can come to regard it simply as a halting place on our journey. We've completed one stage. We must pause for a time during which we review the stage we've completed, gather knowledge from the lessons of experience gained during that time, and prepare ourselves to set out on the next stage, clad in new raiment. This knowledge will help us to lose much of the agony that is associated with the loss of those whom we love. For we will realize that though we are bearing the physical parting, we have not really lost them, and we'll meet them again along the journey. As a man goes into the next stage of his journey, he is the same person as before, though his body and surroundings are different, with all the inheritance, whether for good or evil, that he has made for himself in the past. We see then that the real man, the individual, who goes on from life to life, in his innermost self, never changes. The physical body each time is different. The personality is new. These are disintegrated at the end of each life. But the individual spirit, the true man, goes on from life to life, carrying the seed of all his experiences. Of course, when I say he never changes, I don't mean that he isn't, his life isn't fuller, that he isn't unfolding, that there isn't a greater capacity and more of his true self developing and showing itself. But the identity is there, this self which makes it possible for him to preserve his identity from life to life. Now the question arises, and it's one that must present itself to every thinking man and woman, especially in times of stress, what's it all about? Why must I pass on from life to death, from death to birth, in this endless round? Why am I having to attend the school of life with all its painful lessons and so little recreation, going from class to class? Let's consider these very logical questions and see whether we can gain some answer that will satisfy us. Obviously, we cannot presume to know the full answer, but nevertheless, we can gain a glimpse which will help us. We have seen that the apparent aim of our life here is to develop all the potentialities that are latent within us, that we do this by means of the experiences we pass through during our lives on earth. We come each life into a different environment, where our experiences must be different from those we've had before. Different qualities and faculties will be brought into play, and our character will thus become gradually more complete in its unfoldment. In a very long series of incarnations, we will presumably pass through every class of experience that earth life can give us, and so our education will be completed. Every faculty will be developed, and we will have achieved the biblical injunction, "Be therefore perfect." That may be a long time from now, but that would seem to be the goal towards which we are travelling. I don't mean that if we achieve that goal that that is the end of our life, that that is the finish of our existence. Probably it is the beginning of a new and richer existence, but it is a goal towards which we can look. We can think of each one, according to the biblical story, as a prodigal son who has gone out from his father's home, returning through his evolution, bringing the fruits of his experiences. Each one of us, then, is a prodigal son who has gone on a long pilgrimage. And now we are returning, starting on the return journey. We too, it is suggested, will return to the bosom of the Father, the source from whom we came, carrying with us the fruits of our eons of experience. And we will, so it is suggested, then consciously unite with the divine spirit of which we are a part, our Father in heaven, and thus we will become conscious co-workers in the great scheme of evolution, no longer blind, but revealing the full glory of the divinity within. Now this gives us a goal to work for. It doesn't mean that it will be the end, but the beginning of a new life of service and cooperation. We will have purpose and meaning, and realize that the end is not annihilation, extinction, that life is not a game of chance, a hopeless riddle that cannot be solved. And so we can see that there is a wide vista of evolution and unfoldment opening before us. And we are thus in a position to apply these teachings to some of the practical problems of life. There is one question, however, which is frequently asked, which we need to consider briefly. Why, if man is divine in his origin, is it necessary for him to go through all this long process of evolution and to experience all manner of so-called evil and sin? Why could he not have remained pure and untouched by what we call evil all through? To these questions, the answer is often given, and perhaps it's not a complete answer and not fully satisfactory, nevertheless it does help us, that there could be no knowledge of good without the experience of its opposite, which we call evil, just as we would have no knowledge of the light unless at times we experienced the darkness. We could never develop the strength to hold the good unless we gained it through conflict with and resistance to what we call evil. From this we learn that good and evil are purely relative terms, and that which is good at an earlier stage is evil at a later one for us. Conversely, that which is good at a later stage is sometimes undesirable at an earlier one, since man would not appreciate it. Similarly, that which is good for one individual is by no means necessarily good for another. Seen in this light, the problem of evil finds a solution reconcilable with the teaching that all existence is the expression of the one life. There is nothing which is evil in its essence. Everything is good in its right place, but becomes evil if removed from that place. And all the suffering that we see around us, and which at times may even seem to break our hearts, is the means by which we can learn the hollowness of desire. This, of course, is the essence of the teaching of the Buddha. Unless there is resistance of some sort, there will be no increased effort. There will be no incentive to try. Everything will be too easy. Our whole experience teaches us that nothing gives us so much pleasure as that for the attainment of which we have had to strive and to suffer. And what we call sin we begin to regard then in a different light. He who sins has yet to learn the lesson through pain and experience that will come. We know that sooner or later he will reach the turning point, and then he will need a friend to stand by him. And so great a charity will begin to mark our conduct and attitude towards others. And so also we shall understand that if we have ourselves grown beyond some failing, it is because experience has taught us, and we will have a deeper sympathy for those who are still progressing through that experience. And of course we have ourselves many failings yet to overcome. And so we see that we find this law of evolution, of cause and effect, working at every phase, and that even though we see so much suffering, it is all working towards righteousness. In this talk, though of course I've not been able to touch on any of the points very deeply, we have seen that it is possible to have an idea of life's purpose, to understand the apparent inequality of conditions into which people are born, the differences in capacity and opportunity, the illusion of death and evil, and the goal towards which man is moving. These, I suggest, are practical solutions to practical problems for each one of us. They are not abstruse and beyond our grasp. They can help each one of us to meet our day-to-day problems with greater understanding and less resistance, and to realize our responsibility towards others. We can, in other words, put these ideas to the test for ourselves, make them our own if they appeal to us and if we find they work, and therefore they will have reality for us. They are not just abstruse philosophical concepts. The law of brotherhood will become recognized for us as a fact in nature. We will see that we all share the same life, and ultimately to injure another is to injure ourselves. As a man develops, he gains wisdom and understanding and poise and serenity in the midst of trial and difficulty, finding that he is an immortal self and that the divine life flows within him. The journey of the soul, then, is along the path of ever-increasing realization of his identity with the universal spirit. And when he begins to work in harmony with nature and her laws, he consciously becomes more in tune with the infinite. His progress is from ignorance to understanding. Through the lessons which he learns in the school of life, he finally passes the final exam and is liberated, is free. And so we realize that we are where we are and what we are, because we require just these conditions for our unfoldment, and we are also under the necessity of working out the consequences of our own action, our own activity. Now there is a final thought. Can I prove some of this for myself? Can I know my own immortality? Well, as I said earlier, one of the most beautiful things about this philosophy is that we can put it to the test for ourselves. We can experiment and find out by direct knowledge and perception whether the ideas put forward are true or not. We may not be able to prove it in the science laboratory, but we can prove it by our own intelligence, our own direct experience. Now, how is this to be done? How are you and I to find out that there does exist something more than this personality? How am I to discover and realize directly that I am immortal? Yes, this can be done, each one for himself, through a process of withdrawal into the recesses of one's own being. This, of course, is the purpose of yoga in the East. It is the true mystic experience. Well, you might say, that sounds all very well, but how can I, who have to earn my living, I have to meet the problems of the day, I am caught up in the struggle for existence, how can I spend time in this process? You can, you know, if you really want to. Riding in the bus or tram to work, as you walk along the street, even as you go about your daily tasks, you can begin by sharpening your powers of awareness, beginning to withdraw your identification from these things, beginning to see that your actions, reactions, moods, problems, alliances, attachments are all part of the life of your personality, but they are not you, the real you. You can begin to stand aside from them, look at them objectively, and realize that that which is perceiving, the perceiver, is something different from that which is the object, the perceived. What is it then that watches, that looks? Is it not something else? It is the self, the I, the real you. And by beginning to recognize its existence, you're not escaping from your obligations. You're not escaping from life. You are beginning to find a deeper meaning to it. And instead of being identified with the temporal, the transitory, the ephemeral things of life, you are beginning to base your action from the sense and basis of a deeper reality. And so as you walk along the street, you can begin for yourself this experiment of self-discovery. I am not my physical body. I am not my emotions. I am not my mind. What then am I? Gradually you begin to realize that it is possible to touch another level of being, to experience something deeper, call it spiritual or what you will. You'll remember times when you've had a spiritual insight or contact with the deeper things, even though at the time you may not have realized it as such. When you're looking at a sunset, when you're out in the sea, by the sea, at every moment you can have a deeper experience. And when in great need, This experience helps you to open the channel between the lower and higher self, to find moments of quiet withdrawal, and thus to base your life on your true nature more and more, even though you go about your daily tasks. And so, my friends, I suggest that this philosophy can appeal to every temperament, can help every one of us. It is practical. It provides understanding in meeting our problems. It answers the riddles of life and death and existence. It can appeal to the religious-minded by its affirmation of divine consciousness in all manifestation. It can lead the mystic to a conscious union with that divinity. It can show the more mentally inclined the ancient way through yoga and the stilling of the mind to a realization of the self. And in this way, each one of us can find for himself a practical philosophy which will help him in his daily life. Goodbye, everybody.